Hi, everyone. This is Holly Herndon.
I'm Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to
Interdependence.
Welcome to the Interdependence Podcast, where we host conversations with some of the people we think are shaping 21st century culture. If you're hearing this, then you're listening to the shorter free version. If you're enjoying what we're doing and would like to hear the full episode, please visit patreon.com/interdependence and become a patron. In this episode, we speak to Glenn Weil, author, economist, and principal researcher at Microsoft Research. His ideas inspired the formation of the Radical Exchange Foundation, who recently held a conference in which we were speaking alongside Audrey Tang, Digital Minister of Taiwan, Vitalik Buterin of Ethereum, and others. Head over to radicalexchange.org and look out for the deep list of archive talks. In this very candid discussion with Glenn, we cover his recent work on COVID-19, his recently published essay, AI is an Ideology, Not a Technology, co-authored with Jaron Lanier, his belief in the urgent need for pluralistic technologies and transitioning from corporations to stakeholder democracies, as well as his personal political transition from California libertarianism to socialism. It's a fun and generous conversation. I hope you enjoy. So, hi, Glenn. It's so nice to have you on Interdependence today. Do you mind just briefly introducing yourself to our audience?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. So my name is Glenn Weil. I work at Microsoft, where I advise our senior leaders about geopolitics, macroeconomics, and the future of technology, and lead a team of sort of designer, futurist, humanist, et cetera, type people. I also am the founder and chair of the Radical Exchange Foundation, which is a global social movement around social innovation, new ways of imagining our political economy. And I just recently stopped co-chairing one of the main COVID responses in the United States, the one out of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard.
And that's also great context too. We never got to actually ask you how you felt that went, because obviously we'd scheduled to speak with you prior, and it was right at the inception of COVID. How did you feel those recommendations that you published were received?
It's a very complicated answer. I mean, in one sense, I think it was incredibly successful. I mean, the recommendations were adopted by the Biden campaign as their official policy. They've also been incorporated into the official policy of three U.S. states, major U.S. states. The president, sort of on and off, was interested in them, and then, you know, critical of them, and then interested again. And on the other hand, I feel like we completely failed, because the reality is that getting a lot of attention, getting interest, getting engagement is all fine and nice, and it didn't stop the U.S. from having one of the most disastrous responses in the world, nor stop sort of what I think is even more scary, which is kind of the collapse of the whole Western order that we're seeing around us right now. So in some ways we accomplished a lot, in many ways we completely failed.
And so am I right in thinking that you would draw a connection then between a COVID policy, or maybe a lack of COVID policy, and the way in which the protests are taking place on the streets at the moment?
Yeah, I think the protests are a start. You know, when the Arab Spring started, it was a guy burning himself because of government fuel subsidy cuts. I'm not saying that that's, you know, there's much deeper issues underlying the protests, but I think that they reflect a much deeper sense of a loss of legitimacy of the social and economic, you know, systems of the West. And I don't think that they will end with the focus on the police brutality. I think they will expand outward from there to address a range of issues that have really been dramatized by the present moment. You know, there's a cluster of countries in Asia and Oceania, some in Eastern Europe, where there's going to have been very little loss of life, minimal economic damage, and another cluster in Western Europe and the United States that are going to have, you know, suffered the worst economic shock they've ever seen and have lost, you know, a good chunk of a percent of their population. And I think that's going to lead the sort of slow decay in confidence and legitimacy in Western liberal democracy to turn into a very quick collapse in that confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting to contrast the response in the US to the response in Germany where we are right now. I mean, I don't know if you've been following it, but Merkel just signed this huge, I guess you could call it a kind of Green New Deal last week. Yeah, and it's also just such a different kind of feeling on the street here as well. Of course, there's an entirely different politic here, but
yeah, she's gained a huge amount of support. Absolutely. Germany is sort of an in-between case, I would say. There is there's been some Eastern European countries, Estonia, Austria, that have been like incredibly successful. Germany is further to the west physically and also more connected to what we think of as Western Europe. It's done almost as well as a lot of those more successful Eastern European or Oceania countries. So it's maybe one of the greater hopes for the West that there is a successful example that feels physically closer to home.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the major aspects of her new initiative, I guess kind of her swan song, is that they're investing a ton in digitalization, which is a term that I find really funny here, but also in AI and green technology. So maybe this is a good place to pivot towards a recent article, fairly recent article that you penned with Jaron Lanier for Wired. I think it was called AI is an Ideology and Not a Technology.
Yep.
Yeah. So you talked about several ideas on there that really are kind of aligned, I think, with some of the thinking that we've been doing around AI and music. So I would love to kind of dive into that a little bit.
You guys played an important role in inspiring some of them. You know, that's why I was so excited when I first read about your work.
That's nice to hear.
Oh, wonderful. Did you have a question you wanted to ask about?
Yeah, I guess up front, I mean, we have some thoughts on the specifics, but I wonder, you know, would you maybe just be able to summarize kind of like on a high level what, you know, what the goal and the content of that piece was, and then we can maybe dive into it, because we're paraphrasing from different paragraphs or whatever, but ultimately it's better to hear it from the horse's mouth.
And we'll definitely link to this in the show episode people can dive deeper.
Yep.
Yeah, that's great. So, I mean, the basic idea of that piece is that AI is not a specific technology. It's a way of conceptualizing or imagining a cluster of actual technologies. The actual technologies differ. Some of them are machine learning things. Some of them are, you know, programming of logical systems. And in fact, it evolves exactly what technologies one's actually referring to. AI is instead a way of imagining those technologies as representing sort of autonomous systems that will replace human beings and are independent of them, and that, you know, are maybe designed by a few geniuses or whatever, but are not really sort of something that harnesses and connects people, but instead operates based on that design to serve the needs that people have without their active co-participation in creating those ends. So it's really a ideology. It's an ideology very related to central planning. You know, the imaginary central planning is that there's like a small number of people who is this central planning committee who will just make everything run, and then everybody else can just do their part and, you know, enjoy the fruits that come out of that.
Mm-hmm. The technocracy. It's funny. We, a couple of points bring to mind on that. Like, number one, on a really practical level, like when we were working on the record, for example, we came up with basically a narrative construction for what the AI component of the record was, namely Spawn, which we described as a child that needed to be raised. But of course, Spawn is just a bunch of, like, you know, different TensorFlow
techniques, different architectures. Yeah.
Yeah. But in a
sense, you know, it's actually really funny that you use that particular phrase, because have you read a piece by Ted Chiang called The Life Cycle of Software Objects?
You know, what's really, really funny is literally this week, a good friend of ours, Hannes Grassiger, who's a Swiss journalist and economist, sent us that. And I haven't read it yet, but I'm now guessing that's why he sent it to us.
It is like exactly what you just said. It's one of the best things that I've read recently about these issues.
Oh, great. Well,
we should reach out to him.
Yeah, we should. Yeah. That's incredible. Well, also the other side is, are you familiar at all with the work of Benjamin Bratton?
He runs Strelka, if you're familiar with that.
No, I am not, and I should be.
he's a really interesting guy. He teaches at UC San Diego, and he wrote, probably his most famous book was a book called The Stack. And this, I think it came out like five or six years ago, but he runs a kind of like a free postgraduate course in Moscow, in which different interdisciplinary people are invited to, basically they have an all expenses paid trip for a number of months to study with each other. We were invited to teach as part of, sadly, the kind of disrupted most recent Strelka group. And the topic of the group was, or the topic of kind of the gathering was framed as the artificial. And what's really interesting, I think, with what Ben did with that is he framed the idea of artificiality, how to put this, there's kind of a core paradox at the core of the very concept of artificiality, namely that artificial ultimately means human created, right? And when thinking about the record, so artifice is basically the construction of something by human hands in order to, in some ways, kind of obfuscate something. And many times when we were looking at the record,
rather than a definition of unnatural, which is what I think a lot of people,
exactly. Rather than this idea of like kind of a very outmoded, I think, idea of something being inherently natural or unnatural, actually, you know, a lot of what we can understand to be the artificial is simply stuff that we've constructed. And of course, that stuff can be constructed for ill will or for goodwill.
Well, I think what you're saying is very interesting. I mean, I think it's one of a couple of contradictions that are at the core, in my view, of the imaginary of artificial intelligence. The term artificial intelligence is often used interchangeably with the idea of like autonomous systems. And yet I think it's inherently contradictory with that, both words are in contradictory with that. First, artificial means it's created by humans, and therefore it's not autonomous. And second of all, intelligence, and this is something we should get into more, but I think is inherently, by the nature of intelligence and especially rationality, it's inherently interactive rather than autonomous. And so I actually think the whole concept is incoherent.
What term would you use?
Yeah, I was about to say, is there a better term? Because, well, I know that MIT talked about collective intelligence for a long time. Right. That was like a thing.
And programmers say machine learning. They like to stick to that term. So what's your, you know, term of choice?
Well, I don't necessarily think the set of technologies that get grouped together under artificial intelligence belong appropriately grouped together in that way. Mm-hmm. I don't think there has to be an alternative which denotes everything which is intended to replace humans, because things aren't intended to replace humans. They should be intended to complement humans. So it's just not the right way of thinking about the problem, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. One of the parts of the piece that resonated with us the most is ultimately this idea of kind of the artifice of artificial intelligence, necessarily in a sense kind of obfuscating or camouflaging the very, very real human labor that goes into the vast majority of these techniques, right? Like there are some untrained kind of semi-autonomous systems that can learn by themselves. For example, the stuff, I forget what it's called now.
AlphaGo.
Yeah, exactly. What is the AlphaGo, the new AlphaGo system? There's a particular system that they use that
oh, the like self-training, yeah.
Yeah, that's self-training. Irrespective though, that's really recurrent really minority. Neural nets? It is RNN, but it's a particular thing. But the point being is that those have very, very narrow applications that tend to be good at winning at games, right? But in almost all other cases, what you're talking about here is a very, very thin cover kind of suggesting some kind of autonomous genius, when in actuality, and I think you mentioned a piece, OpenAI training on, you know, millions of translation documents or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in actuality, all that this kind of narrative or this ideology is doing is serving to kind of cover up the really difficult problem of how to, you know, accredit and remunerate people who contribute to these big systems.
Right. And so with our project, we were able to really control it on a kind of micro level, because we could, you know, we were only using the data sets that we were generating ourselves. And so we were able to pay our ensemble members. And, you know, it's such a different project when it's like an art project in that way. But when you start looking at larger scale problems, like, you know, curing cancer or like climate change or things like this, where you need like really, you know, massive data sets, obviously, you know, you encounter different kind of issues around that. So,
yeah, and so in the piece explicitly, you know, you talk about this. Would you mind elaborating a little bit more on, you know, this kind of artificial representation of exactly how autonomous these systems are from humans?
Yeah, I mean, so I think we can talk about these systems in particular, and then we can also talk about the more broad issue of human intelligence, which I think has been misunderstood as being autonomous as well. And that's one reason why it's incorrectly being modeled as such. But, you know, you think about, let's say, Siri or, you know, Google Translate. All of these are trained on huge data sets of, you know, human-generated content. They are then often labeled by humans, and then they produce some output that serves a number of humans. That sounds a lot to me like a bunch of people carrying bricks, building a building that many people can then use. so that's what production has always been about. It's always been about humans doing work and creating something that, you know, then doesn't need to be repeated, wrote every time. It instead stands for other humans to use. So as such, like, I don't really view there as being much fundamental distinction between what, quote, autonomous systems or artificial intelligence are doing and any other production technology.
It's difficult in a sense, right? Because even though I think we agree with you that you know, the traditional labor relations shouldn't be omitted just because there's a new shiny tool. There are subtle differences, right, in terms of, you know, people passively consuming contributions to a data set versus deliberately turning up at work to pick up a brick, right?
Well, I think our conceptions of labor have changed greatly over time. You know, I pay to go lift heavy weights, and I get paid to chat with you guys about the nature of, you know, artificial intelligence and speculate on philosophical matters. And, you know, there's times in human history when it would have been the reverse. That long ago.
I think it's maybe useful to think about the history of sampling here, because I think it shows how the nature of contribution is changing so dramatically, especially in music. So, for example, you know, with the, like, 20th century music, we saw the introduction of recording technology, which allowed us to then fast forward to sampling technology, which meant like entirely new genres of music could be created out of sampling older music. And you know, we had laws and kind of remuneration built into or that kind of like sprang up around that. So like if you sampled someone else, you were required to pay for that. That often didn't happen, but at least that's the law as it was stated. And now with a neural net, it actually kind of changes the nature of sampling in a way where you can kind of you can sample the kind of vibe of or the compositional logic of someone, which is it's more difficult to kind of legislate around, and it's more difficult to kind of create like IP law around and to kind of trace even where certain kind of like stylistic decisions come from. So I think the kind of contribution becomes so much less one-to-one because it's not like a piece of recorded audio that could be stolen. It's more of a kind of like, you know, a logic. And I find that so much more difficult to kind of trace in a way.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. And that's been true at many junctures in the history of technology, that sort of models that were developed for one purpose don't port to other purposes, right? And, you know, we've had to do that with electricity. Like, you know, electricity is like generated in some central place and then it goes over these wires, and who owns the wires and what is it even that's mm-hmm. traveling over it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, like technology constantly confronts us with these things. And it's not that they're trivial to address, but it's also not as if they sort of leave us in a realm where the only option is to allow some like tiny number of people who control the platforms to gain all the benefits.
And so what in your mind would be a proposal to alleviate us of the kind of the burden of the contemporary narrative of AI?
Well, one of my favorites is from Audrey Tang, the digital minister of Taiwan. You know, she has a way of talking about it. I don't know if you've read her poetic mission statement. I have an adapted version that we use for my group at Microsoft. Have you ever seen that?
I actually have, but it's been a while since I've read it. So can you remind us?
Yeah, I'm going to read it to you. This is actually not hers. This is my adaptation of it for my group, but it's similar. When we see the Internet of Things, let's make it an Internet of Beings. When we see online democracy, let's make it deliberative democracy. When we see virtual reality, let's make it a shared reality. When we see new economy, let's make it a dignified economy. When we see machine learning, let's make it collaborative learning. When we see digital identity, let's make it intersectional identity. And when we hear the singularity is near, let us remember that the plurality is here.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's what I would call pluralistic technology, mm-hmm. or pluralistic humane technology or something like that. And that would be my alternative vision to autonomous systems, you know.
And how realistic would you say, I mean, we, for example, had a conversation recently with a researcher at Google Magenta, a guy called Jesse Engel. And we're having a conversation with him specifically around some of these kind of IP hurdles, right? The difficulty in, now Magenta, who, you know, we're building on TensorFlow, and of course a lot of the tech in music, at least, so a lot of the tech that OpenAI uses, for example, is tech developed by Google. We're having a conversation with this guy about, you know, the fact that, one, we are in a strange position as composers because, as you say, there are certain concepts that we're inheriting from a different time that don't really port over to these challenges, right? Like, one challenge that we have to convey to people, and we repeat it quite a lot on this podcast, actually, is that composing with models or being able to kind of aggregate the compositional logic of somebody else is just a new deal that requires reverence and requires kind of new approaches towards making that somewhat fair. Is there any movement toward a more interdependent or pluralistic approach as of yet?
Well, I happen to work at one of those companies, Microsoft. My group is, that mission statement that I just read you is the mission statement for my group at the Office of the Chief Technology Officer, which is a pretty central strategic part of the company. I'm not saying that means that the company buys into it or would endorse the things that I'm saying. I speak for myself, but, there's certainly engagement and thinking about it. And also out of the Office of the Chief Technology Officer and building off of this framework, we have a project called Data Dignity, which I guess you you and I will talk about a little bit later. But Microsoft, at least, has quite a lot of interest in this. Uber has also been thinking quite a lot about how to value and compensate the data contributed by their drivers and riders. So, yes, absolutely. I think that it's sort of unavoidable that these folks are going to eventually have to confront the limitations of existing models if they want to even have societies to serve. So, if they ultimately, if they eat everything around them, there's going to be nothing, there's going to be no value left for them to benefit from. And if they, have to deal with the pesky people in between, they're going to probably end up facing some sort of a social revolution around them. So I don't think that they can avoid dealing with it in some way.
Yeah, we've also seen other projects. I mean, for example, like small impositions where Facebook was working on kind of like a dye-in-the-blood approach to individual data contributions to data sets and stuff like that. It's tricky though, right? I mean, the one thing that you touch on a little bit in this piece, and I think you talk about more explicitly in the Data Dignity work, is this idea of kind of, the value or the problem of asking, how to properly compensate these kind of contributions, right? Because on the one hand, there's been a number of like very, very kind of libertarian free market approaches, which would say that we should treat this all as individual issue, right? Like, I know of a number of projects in the crypto space, for example, that are, ultimately geared toward individual personal data markets, which I personally have to say, it sounds like a really bad idea. Then maybe it is a good time to talk about data dignity a little bit, because
yeah, it's perfect.
One of the really compelling things in this that I think complements this kind of like human focused or kind of collective focused pluralistic approach is what you propose as data coalitions?
There's different words, but we usually use the word data cooperatives.
Okay.
Data unions is another term that we use sometimes. So.
Wonderful. Please, can you explain a bit more what that might look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So, just to take a analogy that you guys used before, the way that rights are collected for music is not actually by like individual musicians enforcing their absolute property rights over their works. There's actually collective administration bodies like ASCAP and so forth that set standardized rates and rules of how that property interest, which exists in principle in the law, but as a matter of practice is not administered that way, what those actually translate into in reality, right? And I expect the same thing will and should be true for the value of people's data. All data pretty much pertain to multiple people. So you take that, for example, thing that you were sampling from someone, it's not actually true that that was created just or even necessarily primarily by the one person who is getting the credit in that moment for it. In fact, most cultural production, you have to, if you try to roll things back, trace back and back and back and back in 1,000 different ways, right? And similarly, almost all relevant, quote, personal data is not actually private to that one person. It always pertains to other people as well. Is this conversation we're having, if you did not publish it, personal data? Well, whose personal data is it? Is it my personal data? Is it your personal data? It's kind of, it's inherently troubled and ambiguous and confusing, right? So that is really, I think, core to what data is. Data is inherently interpersonal rather than individual. And we need both data structures, you know, alternatives to things like the blockchain, and legal ownership structures that reflect the inherently collective and interdependent nature of data.
Yeah, I would agree. It's funny when we've been looking at it, you know, and this is more explicitly in the realm of music, but seeing as you know what ASCAP is, that's great. We can we can chat about it. There seems to be some actually pretty cool practices in the realms of the kind of administration of indigenous musics. In the sense that oftentimes, because when you're dealing with folk music, often you know, the provenance of that idea or that song is actually really, really difficult to trace. And in many cases, there are councils of basically representatives of different indigenous groups that you have to petition in order to be able to use a certain song or a dance within, you know, a commercial performance. And ultimately, that council can, you know, both approve the use of the collective IP, and also ingest those funds to be able to fund common resources for the community at large, right?
Exactly.
Which is really, really interesting that precedent kind of exists. And obviously, with those groups, it's really, really important that it has existed. But yeah, I wonder, are there other examples that you might be able to share with us where you think is there precedent for this in peculiar places?
Absolutely. I mean, look, a lot of, you know, you take them a classic form of property, land. The reality is that while everyone thinks of their house as being their private property, there are so many restrictions on what you can actually do with your property that come from zoning. Mm-hmm. There are taxes on your property that are paid into common pools that maintain the city. Almost all the value of your property, if you live in a big city, comes from the location, which is driven by the investments that are made collectively and the people who choose to locate there, rather than by the individual contribution. So I actually think it's just the essence of many forms of, quote, property that they're collective. Now, I think data is especially that way. But I think we have plenty of precedents for the notion of much of the value of things that nonetheless pertains in some way to individuals being captured through collective processes.
I think maybe one criticism that I've seen of this concept of data coalitions is maybe coming from like a very European perspective and thinking about, instead of all of these kind of fragmented coalitions, that something like this should rather be state run. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think one problem with that is that, you know, it's not even clear that the state is less fragmented. Like, people talk about the state as if it was some unitary, overarching giant thing that covers the whole world. The reality is, especially in a place like Europe, there is no such thing as the state. There's a bunch of different national governments. There's subnational governments. There's the EU. And much of this production occurs not within any particular, you know, jurisdiction, but cross jurisdiction. So I think the state is like an imaginary thing that you know, it's like God or something like that that people think exists, but the reality is that we actually live in a world of all these different intersecting patterns, and the question is, what pattern can we get that most closely matches the nature of the production that we're talking about? I mean, the users of Facebook, if they were all to form a coalition, would cover far more of the world than would any nation state. Mm-hmm. And by the way, a lot of people who are like, oh, the state should do it, they don't even like the states that represent them. They like are deeply dissatisfied with those states. You know, like, do you really want Donald Trump running like the data coalition and saying, I mean, people would laugh, but it's not a laughing matter. I mean, it's the reality is that is the state. Like, and no one has a concrete plan for getting an alternative to that. Like almost all the major European countries have significant threats of some like populist leader taking over them. So it's not as if there exists this like mythical thing called the state that is just like out there to do a ton of good. There are actual like governments. That's what we have, you know?
It's true.
And,
carry on, sorry.
No, please.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I agree and disagree. I mean, I think that like one of the more interesting things and with a lot of the projects that you do that I think is really useful in kind of questioning these fictitious, these kind of like spectral anomalies, right? Is that, you know, ultimately, if you do have a democratic process that democratically elected governance process or a democratically elected council, who is to say that that's not a valid form of government? Of course, the challenge to that is that the state, so to speak, has a monopoly on extracting taxes, right? And so...
But does it? I mean, I don't think the state has any monopoly on extracting taxes. I pay most of my taxes to you know, the car company, to to a landlord, to that's where I pay most of my taxes. I don't pay most of my taxes to the government. Do you?
We live in Germany. We pay a lot of tax.
Yeah, it was like, the state looms very large. The state can shut your bank account down here if you receive a gas bill.
I feel like the reality or the presence of the state is perhaps more like prescient here.
Yeah. But that being said, I mean, I think there is a core tension because obviously, like, you know, we, as part of this, as part of this podcast, you know, many of the people that we'll have on naturally, because it kind of syncs with our interests and politics, honestly, are people are from the European left, right? So the first person that we spoke to actually as part of the series was Evgeny Morozov. We had Guy Standing on last time, who's kind of almost like a guild socialist in the traditional sense. It is really difficult in a way. There are kind of like, there's a lot of details lost in translation also between different societies. Mm-hmm. And there is also a lot of stigma associated with the idea of these things being somewhat autonomous or autonomous of state borders. That being said, you also find yourself in a position that we're very sympathetic to, that, you know, starting a guild based on a certain trade or set of political interests transnationally is something that we can do, right? And waiting for revolutionary political activity to happen at the ballot box, particularly in a place like the United States, is, you know, you could be waiting for a very long time, sadly.
Well, I mean, I want to go further. I mean, look, I do not think that nation state-based democracy is what anyone actually wants if they're truly on the left. Like, what is it that's so attractive about that? You want the interests of the majority of people within a given currently existing polity to be what determines what issue? Like, what issue is it that you think that would be good at determining? Like, do you think that it would be really good if the majority in the United States determined drug and policing policy within the United States? You think that would lead to good outcomes? Is that something we should be really excited about? Would it really be good if the majority of people in the Netherlands decided about all the rivers that terminate in the Netherlands and what the policy should be applied to them, or that the majority of people in Brazil should govern the Amazon? You think that's a great outcome? I mean, I just don't understand the logic. Just because something's collective, I mean, we could have a collective of a bunch of rich people. You know, I could get together like the people who run the biggest banks and we could say, well, let's have a democracy among them. And you'd say, well, that's exclusionary. It excludes other people. And so are nation states. So I just don't understand it. I just think people somehow are just like not paying attention to the words that are coming out of their mouth. Mm-hmm. If what they're talking about is nation state based democracy.
Isn't that a bit of an indictment of democracy itself, though?
No, not necessarily. Well, I mean, it depends what one means by democracy. I think that, you know, democracy should mean that we have symmetries of power, that if one group of people has power over another, that other group of people has a symmetric and opposite power over the other group. And to the extent that we have interactions across nation states, that implies that power, you know, because power relations cross national borders, so too must governance. And of course, that's always been central to the European project and the project mm-hmm. of the European left. So I don't think there's anything weird or whatever about this. I just think people have gotten themselves into a pattern of talking that's completely inconsistent with their own commitments.
It's tricky, right, in these cases, because, I mean, particularly when you bring up something like the United States, you have like, I mean, there are quite valid questions to be asked about the efficacy of democracy in the United States, period, right? Because there are certain vulnerabilities baked into the Constitution, this idea of somewhat representative, or like the idea that someone voting in rural Arkansas has an impact on you know, the representative of somebody living in Manhattan.
Yeah, there are many... well, but put that aside. Like, look, basically, even if you had whatever your, you know, ideal version of standard democracy is, I mean, there's visions of democracy that I'm much more sympathetic to that we can get into later if you want. But almost any standard system of democracy in the United States is just not going to yield solutions to, like, the fundamental problems of the deep racial cleavages in the United States. It's a country of a majority of white people right now. And there are a lot of groups that those people have historically oppressed. And there's just no simple way out of that. It's like, you know, Israel has one of the most vibrant democracies in the world among Jews, and it excludes lots of other people. And the fundamental problem is that it excludes those other people. The solution to that problem is non-exclusion, and to, you know, and to find ways also to protect minorities. And that's just not going to be solved simply by, like, oh, let's have, you know, no electoral college or whatever, you know?
Okay, so if you're not interested, or if we're, like, looking at a kind of, like, post-state democracy, what's the alternative to a state if we don't want a kind of, like, corporate democracy?
Well, and on top of that, like, what is to stop people? I mean, it's funny that there's a book that we've read and keep bringing up by, are you familiar with a guy called Ernest Kallenbach?
No, I don't know him, but I should look.
He wrote
into
a
it.
Book called Ecotopia.
And he wrote it in Berkeley in the 60s
or 70s. Anyways, it inspired the Green Party in Germany.
Yeah, it's basically like a kind of, it's a vision of a future. And I'm not necessarily saying whether this is a positive or negative thing. It's a vision of a future of, you know, there a scenario where there was impending ecological peril, and the states basically became a kind of patchwork of different self-identified groups that traded with one another, right? And so there's whole passages of the book where different groups assume different approaches toward technology and toward trade or whatnot.
Well, the dystopian part of the novel is that it assumes that the Black population and the white population would never be able to cohabit, so mm-hmm. they created two separate states.
Which was, I think, at the time also considered a progressive proposition.
Perhaps.
Right, like I think that now that approach might be treated with more skepticism. But I wonder, you know, on the nation state idea, you know, how does one create a coherent identity or sense of belonging outside of those kind of large tents, so to speak?
Well, I mean, I don't think that what you said about, oh, corporate democracy should just discard that. I mean, I don't want to put too much emphasis on that. But look, imagine that you actually turned some of the major corporations that exist into democracies that were accountable to their stakeholders in the same way that you know, nation states are, or even more powerful ways.
Mm-hmm. When you say stakeholders, do you mean stakeholders or shareholders? Because those are really different.
Stakeholders. Okay. Yeah, okay. Not their shareholders, specifically okay. Not the owners of the capital in them. So, like, you know, their workers, their consumers, et cetera. Imagine that there was a democracy among those groups that controlled the corporation. That doesn't strike me as such, I mean, that actually seems to me very consistent with the traditions of guild socialism. In some ways, and it's actually the definition of guild socialism.
this is going so much faster and wilder than we expected. So really, really great, but please keep talking.
Yeah, no, so I mean, so... Look, I think that we should have a pluralistic vision of democracy. The problem that I have is people who are obsessed with nationalism, and then they are, like, upset about nationalists like Donald Trump, but all they can imagine is a nation state based democracy. I mean, that to me is totally bizarre. It's like I think they're like an inch away from the, you know, nationalists. And yet they think that they're on the opposite side.
I really, really kind of agree that it's a very powerful idea to think all of a sudden of, you know, running one of these large corporations like a democracy. That being said, it's quite an outlandish idea, right? I mean, we're quite a way away from that.
Is it really more outlandish than having a you know, United States that respects the rights of African Americans? I don't think it's at all more outlandish. I mean, look, I work at one of these companies. I'm in conversations with people. There's all sorts of movement on stakeholder capitalism. There's all sorts of movements on these sorts of things. Why is that so much more outlandish, unbelievable than that the United States would do justice to Black people? I mean, I find the idea that the United States is going to do justice to Black people, you know, we've been working on that for a fair while. I think in my book, you know, a couple centuries, something like that. And, you know, we've made some progress, but it's been pretty limited. But the thing is, you're assuming, and this is one fundamental problem that I have with all this revolutionary, you know, standard revolutionary discussion, is that you're assuming that there's like going to be one act that is going to fix all the problems in the world. I'm saying that a very good direction one could go in is democratizing existing organizations with power.
I think we're all on board with that one.
Yeah, we're totally agreed.
Yeah, and like, we're not all either going to make the nation state serve the interests of oppressed minorities within it all in one stroke, right? We need to imagine more creative directions for improvements along many dimensions. And I'm just suggesting that we shouldn't limit or even focus primarily our attentions on, you know, nation state politics being the only avenue there.
If you're hearing this, then you're listening to the shorter free version. If you're enjoying what we're doing and would like to hear the full episode, please visit patreon.com/interdependence and become a patron.